From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We've all heard the apocryphal George Washington cherry tree story, but on today's show, writer and Wisconsin native Peter Stark tells the tales of the real young George Washington.
We have the sense of this guy who's born selfless, faultless judgment. You know, it's sort of an immaculately conceived man-god who arrives on the scene and he leads the colonies to independence and becomes the first president. And that's not the way it happened at all.
Film contributor Dave Lurson reflects on why a soft-spoken and gentle man in a zip-up cardigan playing with puppets and the documentary about him has touched so many people.
It seems unlikely, but somehow it worked, maybe because of the genuineness, the aura of integrity that surrounded his presentation.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This past week, we celebrated the 4th of July, the annual holiday in which we celebrate the founding of the United States. Most of us learned many of the details of our nation's founding in our history classes, from the Articles of Confederation to the Continental Congress, the Declaration of Independence, and battles such as Valley Forge and Yorktown. We might think we know a lot about our founding fathers, but there are large parts of their lives that aren't found in many of our history textbooks.
Writer and Wisconsin native Peter Stark knew what we all knew about George Washington. Stark's writing specialties are adventure and history, and during some time in the relatively wild reaches of western Pennsylvania, he discovered it was a place that a young George Washington had some experiences that informed the leader he became. Stark set out to learn more, and the result is his new book, Young Washington. He joined us in the studio just recently. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Mitch.
Most of us probably have this image of George Washington as being kind of from this, you know, lauded, noble English family. But from what you write, that really does not seem to be the case. So what was George Washington's upbringing like and his ancestry?
He has a really interesting ancestral background. Basically, the short version is that the Washington family had been trying to climb to the upper echelons of the aristocracy for centuries, first in England and then in Virginia. And with remarkable consistency, they had not made it. The Washington men tended to marry wealthy landed widows. The men would rise in status to gentleman status. They'd have like 18 children. The wealth would disperse and they'd kind of sink back down. George Washington's great-grandfather essentially got shipwrecked in Virginia on a trading venture, married a magistrate's daughter. Magistrate gave him 700 acres of land, you know, so here's the wealthy fortuitous marriage. And that established the Washingtons. And so for the next four generations until George was born in 1732, they were tobacco planters at kind of a middling level. And George was very ambitious to climb out of that.
That was really what sets George apart is his ambition.
Incredible ambition. It's very notable from the time he's a teenager. And one of the things I've felt about in all my exposure to this part of his life is that his father died when he was 11, and his older brother, whom he revered, died when he was in late teens, and he was never very close to his mother. And I've thought that if his father hadn't died so young, he would have been more anchored in the world, more sure of himself, really. And so, but he was so determined to make a name for himself.
Well, and so well before he is a founding father, he is a surveyor. There is a lot of land out there with which to survey. But give us a sense for, you know, what the role of surveyors was in, you know, the 1740s and 50s.
Well, you can imagine that in the 1740s and 50s, that's basically 100 years after the Jamestown landings, a little more than that. And the British population was still very much confined to the Atlantic coast. Yet there was a huge stretch of land that lay just over the Appalachian Mountains and the Appalachian foothills and over the mountains. And George started surveying that as a teenager. So he developed very early almost a lust for land. All these Virginia planters were very much about land. And he had a real sense of acquisition for land.
Well, so from that, what is the turn of events that leads to his journey, you know, well to the Northwest to deliver a message to the French commandant in what I guess is now probably the area around Erie, Pennsylvania?
Right. And so, George, you know, when we think of coastal the Atlantic and coastal Virginia, so that's where the British colonies are, of course, the colonies that we know. And then up in Canada, there were the French, and they had, you know, their colony there that dated back to the early 1600s also. So in between was a huge area known as the Ohio wilderness. And it's not just the Ohio we think of today, not the state. It would encompass Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Virginia, on and on and on. It's an area almost the size of France. So in the about 1753, George had just, as a 21-year-old, signed up to be a young officer in the Virginia militia as another way to advance his standing and his career. And he was still surveying, and he was doing a little planting. And he signed up for this job and this post. And at that point, just then, the British governor of Virginia, Virginia Colony, of course, Governor Dinwiddie, heard that the French were building forts out in the vast Ohio wilderness. And Governor Dinwiddie needed someone to deliver a message to the French, basically saying, stay out, all these lands belong to King George. George Washington raised his hand. He had some frontier experience. Governor Dinwiddie dispatched him and sent him over the Appalachian Mountains in late 1753 with a wilderness guide, Christopher Gist. They hit terrible snowstorms crossing the mountains. They were on horseback. They had servants. They got way back into the wilderness after a terrible journey, and they came to a French post. It was greeted by a French officer who said, oh, man, you're in the wrong place, and kind of brushed George off. And remember, George is only 21 years old, and he has no military experience. Very ambitious, and brushes him off, says, oh, you got to ride a week that way to my boss. And so George and Gist and their party do, and through, you know, swamps and mud and rain and snow and on, and get to a larger French post recently built, and there is a distinguished gentleman, elderly gentleman soldier, French commandant, who greets George with, you know, the formal dinner and candlelight and red wine, which is imported from France, and wonderful meats, and the whole formal greeting, and then reads the letter and goes into another room and writes a reply and sends George off. And George goes thrashing back through the wilderness at high speed because Governor Dinwiddie has told him to go with all urgency. And George ends up leaving his horses, which are failing because they can't find enough feed in the snow and the streams are frozen, and he almost dies falling off a raft into a river and all these incredible harrowing adventures. It's amazing he made it. And he gets back to Governor Dinwiddie and hands him the letter. And the letter says from the French commandant, well, our nations are finally at peace. You know, this is after they've been at war for 700 years. And I would very much like to keep the peace. However, as to your request that I should leave, I don't think so. And that's where the real trouble begins.
Well, and what's interesting, a lot of it is interesting, but, you know, of all the people to take on this mission, this is a guy that, you know, he had some frontier experience, but he was not a wilderness expert.
He was not. No.
Not a diplomacy expert either.
Neither of those things. I mean, George starts whining when he first goes into the wilderness that there are no linen tablecloths on the tables of the frontier settlers in their log cabins, and their table manners are terrible. They just eat with a knife and their bed bugs and blah, blah, blah. So he has, you know, he's learning. And so he has very little wilderness experience and no military experience, and that really gets him into a great deal of trouble when Governor Dinwiddie, having read this letter, sends him back into the wilderness at the head of a small military party and to essentially deliver a firmer message to the French. And Governor Dinwiddie warns George, do not be the aggressor and be cautious. George, in his naked ambition, proceeds to do exactly the opposite. He ends up ambushing a small party of French who are having breakfast in a wooded glen on a rainy dawn. And George and his men open fire, and they end up killing a number of these French. George takes the rest of the French prisoner, about 20, 25 prisoners. And you'd think at this point a sensible commander would pause, that this did not go exactly as planned. But George doesn't. He just brazenly pushes ahead, and he's very cocky. He says, well, if the French can put up no more fight than this, I'll drive them back to damn Montreal. And he writes to his brother, I mean, really right after this terrible incident, he writes to his brother and says, I heard bullets whistling, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound. And eventually that got back to King George, who responded, he would not say so if he'd heard many. But what happens is that George ends up getting essentially slaughtered by the French and the Indians and has to surrender, and terrible experience. And this is what touches off the French and Indian War.
How does the transformation take place then from this cocky guy who really, you know, believes a lot in himself without necessarily having the wisdom and the experience to back it up, to a guy who really does come up with the gravitas that one needs to become the commander of the Continental Army?
You know, it's a great question and a really interesting transformation. There are several key moments and events, and the patterns that I see is that he first, instead of being so self-promoting, just remarkably self-promoting, and ambitious and whiny and petulant, complaining about officers who are ranked above him and not enough pay, and he's underappreciated, and he's going to quit. He threatens to quit 7 times, and quits some of them. It goes on and on like that, but he eventually gets put in charge of the Virginia regiment, almost 1,000 men at age 23, very young. And he's responsible for protecting these frontier settlers over a 350-mile-long frontier, which I compare to the Afghanistan-Pakistan frontier of today, an almost impossible task to defend. Through this process, he sees his own men get slaughtered and lying dead in mud and blood in trenches. And, you know, these guys who are his age, who he's been responsible for, he's marched them into this situation, and now they're lying dead all around him. And you see George's sense of empathy start to grow, first towards the men he's leading. And he's also very good about at a certain point, he shifts over and he literally at one point gets down off his horse. And, you know, that's a big thing for a Virginia gentleman to do. And he starts, you know, kind of getting down in the mud and pushing cannons up mountainsides with his men. And, you know, really, he really gets down there in the dirt with them, which is they really bond with that. And then there's no sense that no doubt that he has whatsoever, that he has this incredible bravery. You know, he is utterly fearless. No one ever doubted that about him from the very beginning. And incredibly fortunate at the same time for what he survives. So at one point, the British finally do send a big army of redcoats into the wilderness under General Braddock, it's a famous incident in colonial history. They get ambushed by the Indians and the French. They don't even see the Indians. You know, they're behind trees and they just drop like flies in the middle of the road.
Traditional rules of engagement not applying.
Yeah, here. And the general is marching along saying, well, there's, you know, and the officers are saying, well, we can't have a battle here. There's no place to have a battle. So why would we worry? And of course, the Indians, that's what they do. They fight in that terrain, and it's just, terrible slaughter of hundreds and hundreds. And George is kind of the last officer standing. It's called Braddock's Defeat, this famous battle. And he's a young aide-de-camp to General Braddock, and he rides around delivering messages from the general who's wounded, and George has horses shot out from under him, and then at the end of the battle, he looks at his hat and his coat, and he has 4 bullet holes through his hat and his coat. And he immediately, again, you know, his response to that is he writes a letter to his brother and says, divine providence protected me beyond all human expectation. And at that moment, you know, through that event, one really gets a sense that George starts seeing a larger role for himself, that he's being protected for a reason. And then I think the final thing that's really marked to me is that when he finally does leave the wilderness at age 26 and the British finally pry the French and Indians out of there, George immediately quits. He wants to go back to being a planter. He quits. Within a few weeks of leaving the wilderness, he marries Martha, who's what else? The richest widow in Virginia, who has 17,000 acres of land and dozens and dozens and dozens of slaves, which, you know, of course, is a form of wealth in that those days, that society. And his marriage to Martha instantly brings him up to the top of the Virginia aristocracy. So he doesn't have to worry about his social status anymore. He doesn't really have to worry so much about money. And then I think even more important that Martha gives him this sense of emotional reassurance, and that which he didn't have growing up as a younger man, as an adolescent, as a youth. And George kind of settles down. He becomes a planter for almost 15 years. And then, then we get into the story that we know is that this French and Indian War, which is spread around the globe, known as the Seven Years' War, which started right with George Washington's musket and orders right there. This war finally ends in 1763. 2 years later, in 1765, the British say, "We spent so much money protecting you American colonists. We're feeling really broke, so we're going to put this tax on you guys, the Stamp Act." It causes huge uproar in the colonies, and then the British revoke it, but they add more taxes later, and, you know, we know the story from there. Meanwhile, George is Virginia planter, you know, prosperous, and he's a Virginia, like a legislator. And when things really start heating up, there are the Continental Congresses, and George is a representative from Virginia, one of several. And he goes to the Continental Congress held in May and June of 1775, right after the battles of Lincoln and Concord. The Continental Congress is putting together an army to march against the British in Boston. And they look around the room there in Philadelphia and say, "Who's going to lead this thing?" And, you know, you got short John Adams there and like a lawyer, a mouthy lawyer from from Boston. And he's not a wilderness guy.
Not really a recipe for success, no.
And people look around the room and there's this quiet, tall guy who carries himself with a sort of regal bearing, who knew the gift of silence. And George has always had a thing for uniforms. So he's recently designed a new officer's uniform for the county militia down in Fairfax County. And George at the Continental Congress is sitting there silently with this regal bearing and wearing this incredibly beautiful officer's uniform with all the gewgaws and spangles and braids. And people look over and say, "There's our guy." So unanimously, they choose him to be our first commander in chief.
And amazing to think of this guy who was petulant and threatened to quit seven times as being the same guy who in whatever it was, the 1790s, you know, steps down from the presidency for the good of the country.
Exactly. I think, you know, that this image that we have of George Washington, that I think it's actually done the image that we've propagated in history, I think it's really done a big disservice to Americans and especially younger Americans, that we have the sense of this, you know, guy who's born, you know, selfless, faultless judgment, flawless, you know, sort of an immaculately conceived man god who arrives on the scene and he leads, you know, the colonies to independence and becomes the first president. And that's not the way it happened at all. I mean, he thrashed and he struggled and he made mistakes and he failed, but he learned from them. And so this more vulnerable, more accessible George Washington is one that I find far more inspirational than this distant statue that we have.
One of those cases where the true story is actually far more interesting and far better than the myth.
It's true, yes. I think exactly that, that the true story, it has so much more of a human component, and it's one that I think that we as flawed mortal citizens with all our weaknesses can relate to a lot better than this guy who just strides on the scene and magically leads things to this incredible place.
Peter Stark's latest book is called Young Washington: How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. Stark grew up around Pine Lake in Waukesha County, but now calls Montana home.
A quick break now, and then we'll travel to the land of make-believe with our film contributor Dave Larson. Lake Effect Weekend continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
One last time, the people will hear from me. One last time.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you grew up watching public television, that song may have taken you back to the land of make-believe and into the television home of Fred Rogers. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood first aired in 1968 and aired first-run shows for more than 30 years.
You wouldn't expect that a program with a soft-spoken and gentle man in a zip-up cardigan playing with puppets would have touched so many people. But generations came to know Mr. Rogers as an essential part of their lives, early education, and childhood.
A new documentary by award-winning filmmaker Morgan Neville gives audiences an in-depth look at Fred Rogers. Won't You Be My Neighbor examines the life and legacy of the children's TV host in a flattering but complex way. It features archival footage, interviews with family and friends, and explains how history influenced the series.
Dave Larson is one of our regular film contributors, and he recently visited the studio to share his reflections on the film. Dave, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Always good to be here, Audrey.
So how badly did the world need a documentary like Won't You Be My Neighbor right now?
I think it's extremely timely and sad, really. I left the screening of the film feeling kind of warm and sad, if that makes any sense.
It does.
The ideals of Mr. Rogers have certainly, you know, been much abused, and we live in a very different world than the one I think he imagined. I mean, you know, he wasn't talking about Mr. Rogers' gated community after all. I mean, his idea of a neighborhood, of turning America into a neighborhood, which he defined as a place of safety, where, you know, there are differences of opinion and different kinds of people living in this sort of neighborhood, but everyone could find a way of getting along, and there was a sense of true community, of people helping each other out if there was a need, of resolving differences. We don't live there, I'm really sad to say, but I keep coming back to one of the final scenes of the movie. He was brought back from retirement right after 9/11 to speak to the children of America about that. He looked absolutely shattered, like he could not comprehend how the world had turned to that point.
Right, and people can say what they like about events that have transpired since, but that his presence is definitely deeply missed for that platform, both for children and adults, because I feel most people going to see this may go in for the nostalgia, but as you hinted to before, you're going to leave with something much more impactful.
Well, one thing that I never realized, and I have to say I learned a lot from this documentary, which I think is the purpose of a good documentary, is to teach people something in an engaging, entertaining way. And I think that the documentary does that. It's really brilliantly done by Morgan Neville, Oscar-winning documentarian. Never a dull moment in the Mr. Rogers documentary. But I did not know the subversive character of some of his work early on. You know, at a time when desegregation was being fought by white supremacists, there was footage of white supremacists dumping toxic chemicals into a swimming pool to prevent African Americans from swimming in it. Mr. Rogers, puts his feet into a little, you know, pool, foot tub, I guess, and invites Officer Clemens, the African American patrolman in the neighborhood, to, oh, it's a hot day, why don't you put your feet in the pool with me? I mean, what a statement.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to preach and make a sermon out of it. It was just showing an ideal way that people could live together.
Yeah, a good point that we wouldn't really think about right away upon watching his program was that he was kind of the first televangelist, because he was creating this new formula out of television that you know, was still trying to find its bearings.
Well, he had very definite ideas about television and particularly the impact that television would have on children, presumably the most impressionable audience for TV. He really, I think, hated, if you could say Mr. Rogers hated anything, but he strongly disliked most of what was being offered to children. He fought a losing rearguard action against superheroes, for example. He felt that they were, you know, showing violence and presenting dangerously unrealistic role models for young children who might act. I mean, there was actually a case where a young child jumped off of a building with a cape thinking that he could fly. Well, that doesn't work that way. So televangelist, that's a loaded word. I mean, Mr. Rogers was a Presbyterian minister, but the gospel that he preached was considerably different than the one that the people we think of as televangelists, you know, were going on about. Basically, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. Fundamental idea that many fundamentalists totally ignore. That was the root of his thinking. But you never, I mean, I never knew he was a Presbyterian minister until I saw the movie. I mean, he didn't make a point of that, but he tried to, I think, live out his ideals and present them in the most accessible way he could think of.
Yeah, his pulpit of puppets and trolleys and a house and
the emotional vulnerability that he showed was startling. I mean, sometimes he did this through his alter ego sock puppet, Daniel the tiger, but sometimes it was just him. I mean, a very vulnerable-looking person. And I don't think that very many people, certainly nowadays, would want to put themselves in such a position of vulnerability in public.
Right. It was a flattering yet complex portrait of Fred Rogers. And I also enjoyed the animation that was interspersed in this with him shown as Daniel Tiger. And that, you know, it can confirm that, well, if Fred Rogers has self-doubt, has depression, questions his influence, you know, surely we're all okay to feel that way as well.
Well, that was one of his things, too, was that we all have problems that we have to contend with. And it's okay for, I think, necessary to realize what they are and to find someone you can talk to about it. I mean, kind of talk therapy for children, if you will. The movie points out the backlash against Mr. Rogers, the accusation that one result of his program was to rear several generations of self-absorbed, narcissistic, whiny, petulant people who assume that they are special simply because they exist. And the movie does make it clear that that was not exactly what he was trying to get at. He was not, and I was kind of surprised, he was a Republican. You know, of a sort that doesn't seem to exist any longer. I mean, we have to remember that there were liberal and moderate Republicans, all shades of opinion in that party at the time that Mr. Rogers was coming up. He was against entitlements, but he was in favor of the very basic idea that every human being is worth something. Every human being, by nature of living, has value. And I suppose he would say that you know, beyond that point, you create your value by what you do.
Well, in his lessons, and, you know, the common phrase, mother knows best, and Fred Rogers believed that with the way television and media and the consumer market was going, was that, no, Fred Rogers knows best because these children aren't getting what they need from what's out there at the moment. He was truly someone who would address the child as an individual through the screen. You know, that the controversy that, you know, we're entitled. But then again, now we have, oh, millennials are entitled. They expect everything to be done for them or something like that. So you have that of every generation. But for him to have each child as that special individual, but also the power of acknowledging the feelings you have, sharing them, and also the power of silence.
Well, silence, you know, yes, there's not enough of that in today's world, and there already was a diminishing amount of it in the media of Fred Rogers' time. He understood the importance of silence, which, is the backdrop against which everything happens, for one thing. Silence enables us to think, and maybe one of the things he wanted to do, if you could map out the agenda of Fred Rogers, was he wanted people to think about themselves, think about themselves in relation to other people, think about the effect of what we do on other people and the world that we live in.
He basically created a format with perhaps the worst formula in an era where television was still learning how to walk on its own. You know, he did the writing for the show, composing the music, singing, production. You know, it was a low production value, unlikely star, and yet it turned into this success that aired for more than 30 years.
Yeah, how to account for that? He struck a chord, obviously, with millions of people. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, he intended the show for a preschool audience. I think that the audience was larger than that very soon. Did parents steer their children toward it? Did children discover this on their own while flipping the dial when TV sets had dials on it? Probably a little bit of both. To me, looking at him, he was already anachronistic looking in 1968 when he debuted. He looked like, to my mind, a kind of 1950s camp counselor or something, you know, 10 years too late in this sort of 1950s sitcom living room, you know, sitting around talking. It seems unlikely, but somehow it worked, maybe because of the genuineness, the aura of integrity that surrounded his presentation.
Yeah, and the documentary really did settle a question. Yes, he really was like that, you know, on and off the camera.
Right. I mean, I guess it does indicate that he had his trying moments, though, once in a while. But I'm happy to know it wasn't a fake pose all those years.
Exactly. The skill to consolidate all of this information yet highlight the key moments of both his success and his trying moments. Did you feel that there was a great balance of the archival footage of the show and also of him just interacting with people, but then deeper moments that weren't scripted and also just felt like there was good testimonial balance when typically documentaries can either lean too heavily on one source over another?
Well, I mean, Morgan Neville is very skilled. I've enjoyed some of his previous documentaries. This one will probably, I mean, I think it's certainly Academy Award nomination worthy and may very well win. It's too early to make these kinds of predictions now, but I think because of the widespread interest in the subject, for one thing. But yeah, the animation makes it entertaining and illustrates certain aspects of Fred Rogers' life and ideas. The archival footage, of course, was absolutely necessary given the subject matter. And yes, well-chosen interviews with surviving family and associates. Nice to meet his real children. I mean, to see how they turned out, that's interesting. One of his crew members for the TV show made the kind of, again, a sad, melancholy comment that, nice guys like him aren't as common as they once were. And I think that's very true.
Yeah, and there truly were some, you know, misty-eyed, tear-jerking moments throughout this whole thing. And as you mentioned before, you leave feeling good yet sad. And what are your main takeaways from the film of its message?
Well, the message, it's kind of contrary. I mean, one could wonder whether Fred Rogers was a little bit naive, that he was hoping for something that would be much more difficult to achieve than would be possible. To imagine a country as divisive back in 1968, certainly, and today as well, with different groups of people, contentious points of view, that this could actually become a functioning community in the highest sense, a neighborhood where everyone would feel safe and neighborly and help the other people out who live across the street from you. It's a tall order. I would suppose that to critique Fred Rogers, maybe, you know, evil for him was a theological abstraction. He didn't quite understand the reality of it. That he knew that there were problems in the world, certainly, and he addressed these things, but maybe he didn't quite fathom how bad people can really behave to one another.
Do you feel that this is kind of a reminder of what we're lacking in TV and media nowadays, too? I mean, not just with children's programming, but that impact overall when there's so many shows per channel, per hour, you know,
well,
per platform.
I suppose no one program nowadays for children or for any other particular demographic could have the widespread influence of a Mr. Rogers neighborhood because of the splintered, fractured nature of the media and our attention spans being dragged one way and pulled the other constantly by the hundreds of different options out there. This was still the era of three commercial networks and PBS. So choices were limited, and a show that caught on could really catch on in a bigger way, I think, than anything possibly could now. But I think that what we might be lacking right now is television with the kind of humane values that Fred Rogers tried to put across.
Is there a particular moment or scene or fact that you learned that kept you thinking well past the screening?
Well, I think the power of television or any medium, art form of entertainment to cause people to think about the world they live in without pounding them on the head with the message, to show, you know, how we might be able to live together rather than tell us how to do it.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express newspaper and writer of its I Hate Hollywood blog. He spoke about the new documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is out in theaters now. You can find past film segments and more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, then Lake Effect Weekend returns with the latest episode of X-Fabula on 89.7 WUWM.
By just your being you, only one person in the whole world like you. That's you yourself. I'll be back next time. Bye-bye.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X-Fabula!
True personal story.
X-Fabula!
X-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it's X-Fabula Radio Time. Once again, part of Lake Effect Weekend, every weekend on WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney, X-Fabula co-founder, is here. Every week we have stories based on a theme, and today we ask the question, is it art?
Is it art or is it not art? That is the question. If you've been downtown at all lately, you might have noticed that Milwaukee is just sprinkled with all of these fantastic outdoor sculptures here, and they are amazing, per usual. I just love it. I love how it just transforms the city.
If you walked up Wisconsin Avenue from, like, 6th Street to Cass, there's at least a dozen sculptures, probably more along the way, on both sides of the street. It's fascinating.
It's great, and it just starts conversations in the city. Mm-hmm. Milwaukee, just want to let you know that X-Fabula has a partnership with Sculpture Milwaukee, and we have an event coming up where we're going to have two storytellers guide participants down Wisconsin Avenue, and they're going to share personal stories inspired by those selected pieces. More information about that is on xfabula.org, but in regards to art, we have a couple of art-related stories here to...
Is that spelled A-H-T, art?
Art. It's the Bostonian art. Let's start out today's show with one of our UWM service learners. This was at a slam in May of 2017, Aaron Whitney. So let's listen to Aaron's story.
Hi, so I'm Aaron Whitney. I'm about to graduate with community arts, and I am living currently in a senior living community, High Point, as a student artist in residence. So in exchange for workshops and creative opportunities, I am given housing and a very expanded social circle. So one of the women that I've met in this social circle that's much expanded, she is a writer, a poet, a really creative person, an extremely witty woman with like some of the best pieces of advice I've ever heard, such as it's fun to play and try new things because there's a good chance you probably haven't done it before. So Enid and I had a play that I had to go to for school and I needed a date. So I called Enid, of course. And we decided on Sunday at 1:20 to meet up so that we could go to Collectivo beforehand so we can get coffee, biscotti, the whole thing that you do before a play. When we got to Collectivo, I found out she hadn't been into a coffee shop in like 10 years. And I was just bewildered with this. And we sat down at the big, long shared table that Collectivo has. And right away, before even like the first sip happened, Enid leans over to the our neighbor table girl on the right. She's like, "What you doing?" And right off the bat, this girl was like a little startled, like, "My architecture project." And within moments, we had like six people taking off their headphones, shutting their screens, and like this conversation and communication was happening naturally how it's supposed to. And it was just so exciting. We were late for the play. That's okay. It was a great performance, but during intermission, when the lights came on, Enid did the same thing, and eventually it was, "Well, isn't that character ridiculous?" And again, everyone around us is like, "Yeah, talking about the play and these things that probably wouldn't have happened before." At the end of the play, I introduced Enid to my instructor for my class, and they talked a little bit. They're both writers. They're both interested in theater. We got in the car later, and he has nice eyes. Oh, yeah, Enid. Sure. But so I wanted to do more with Enid. I was like having this moment of like, should we go grocery shopping? Like, I'm not ready to go back to High Point right now. And eventually we decided to go to Black Cat Alley. It's just like a little mural alley on the east side of Milwaukee. And we decided to walk down it, and we're looking at all this art, and she's giving me this commentary, and I'm experiencing this art in a different way that I probably haven't seen it before with my friends. And we're seeing all these people taking like selfies and these couples together. And I'm like, "Enid, would you like to take some photos in front of the murals?" And she's like, "Oh yeah, sure. We took two photos before. She was like, "Well, now we have to take one together." I'm like, "Okay, Enid, sure." And I get ready to take a photo in front of one of the murals, and she's like, "No, let's make ours different." She points over to the dumpsters on the right side. She's like, "Let's take ours in front of the dumpsters that are like blocking the alley." I'm like, "Yes, Enid, that would be fantastic." So I have a photo of Enid and I, two goons in front of a dumpster, and it is one of my favorite photos because it's the whole day all together, and it's a funny photo, first of all, but it means a lot to me. But I guess the whole of this story is that these relationships that are built when you get yourself into the community and you build these little bridges that may help you cross like differences like age or like cultural backgrounds, you can meet people like Enid. So that's Enid, yeah.
And that was Aaron Whitney's story.
Have you ever known someone like that who just opens up to people wherever they are? Doesn't matter if they've ever seen you before, and just starts bringing out things out of people. It's amazing.
It really is. It's something to behold, especially with an older person you just probably don't expect it. And then boom,
yeah,
right there in your face.
I don't have those skills.
So we have the Sculpture Milwaukee event coming up with Exfabula, but we also want to re-alert everybody that everyone should watch our Facebook page, because between July 5th and July, I believe it's 17th, we are going to unleash those themes for our season 10 slams.
All right.
There's going to be voting. Vote all over the place.
All right. I'm there.
Cool. All right. Well, let's jump back into the story. Adam Carr, huge proponent of Milwaukee's art scene and culture scene, fantastic agent of change, and a big friend to Exfabula. He told a story at our Doors Open Slam in September of 2016, where the theme was resurfacing Mitchell Street. So let's listen to Adam Carr.
So there is an excellent event that happens on Mitchell Street on the south side. Its name is Temporary Resurfacing. It's happened twice, and the event that happens, Temporary Resurfacing, is run by a woman named Demetra Kopolis and Marla Sandvik. And what they do is they get a bunch of people from around Milwaukee, around Wisconsin, actually around the country, to come to Mitchell Street for one night and make video projections on the walls of Mitchell Street and in the windows of the stores and in the alleys and behind buildings. People have used payphones. People have done projections in cars. So they activate this two blocks of Mitchell Street with all these different projections and all these really different places. And I participated in both of the times that it's happened. And I picked for myself probably what I thought was the best space until I had to set up. So my spot was, to get to my spot, I climbed to the top of a four-story building, down the fire escape, and then I had to do, at the bottom of the fire escape, there's a top rail and a half bar, and I had to get onto the ledge down there. And over there was a concrete parking lot. So I had to sort of get under, this is gonna be a very physical story. So I had to kind of get under, do like a swivel with my leg around. So if I mess up, It's the concrete down there. So I'm giving myself a little pep talk. Okay, got to hit the swiv. Get the swiv. And I get down on there. Okay, so I made it the first time without dying. I felt good. So I'm starting to set up. I have a couple pieces of equipment that I need to make my projection. So the first is a trunk that has a big projector inside of it. And the second one is kind of a suitcase-sized thing that has the lens for the projector. And then I also have the projector. We assemble the projector. And so everything's set up. It's still light out, so there's a little bit of time before it gets dark where you could see the projection. So I go back up. I swivel back up onto the fire escape, and I help some friends set up. That involves setting up some scaffolding for people. We're doing all these different kinds of crazy projections onto walls. When I start seeing it starting to be twilight, I need to go back up to my spot so I can set up my projection. So I hit the swiv again. Every time, I need to insist, this was very nerve-wracking. I'm not a very agile person necessarily, and even if I am, it's death that way, life that way. So every time I had to talk myself up and hit that swivel. So I swivel back onto the roof, and there I am. The sun is starting to set, and it's a race against time. I got to get my projection set up. I'm on the top of a one-story building. I'm looking over at a four-story building, and my projection is going to go up onto that building. So what I have, again, is this trunk made of plastic. I also have the suitcase made of plastic in this projector. And one note about the projector, if I'm a normal projector, this projector was a really big one. It's like Shaquille O'Neal projector. It's a big, thick, muscular projector that is going to shoot a big, bright beam of light onto the wall. So I had to set up to use the trunk and the suitcase to prop up then the projector to shoot this beam of light where I needed to go. And it was very difficult. Everything I'm working with is made of kind of slick plastic. So everything is kind of sliding around, and I'm using I told you it's a very physical story. I'm using my upper body, and I'm using my legs, and then I'm trying to use my neck to get, and every time I feel like I have it, I let go, and then it swivels, and I see the picture go, like, okay. So I hit it again. I'm like knocking out the power plug. There's a 120-foot power plug that's connecting me to a kitchen outlet. I'm watching my projection, and it's just not coming together. I try this for maybe 30 minutes by myself sit on top of this roof, and I feel like abandoned, like by the world. I'm starting to feel like a lot of resentment, just general resentment, shooting out. Like I'm probably saying things like, they don't even care. I don't know who, I don't know what. I'm just mad. I swiveled up. I risked my life for this. And I'm just looking at these three pieces of equipment that keep on undoing and swiveling themselves. So eventually, I'm literally about to give up. I don't know what giving up means. I'm like, I'm done with this. And I had an idea. I needed something that had grip. I needed something with grip. And I looked down, and I took my shoes off, and I used them to prop up right like that under the projector, and it worked. I did this kind of like herky-jerky pop lock thing that I'm doing here. Got it? I'm looking up. It's perfect. Let go. Still up there, right where I want it. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, I did it. And I go over to the edge, and I look out, and people are seeing it. I'm going, I did it. And then I look down. I'm like, oh, no. I am not going to swivel back up onto that fire escape just in my socks. That is scary. So it's June, so it's about 7:30. The sun had gone down, and this event is going until midnight. So I'm standing there on top of the roof kind of thinking like, okay, what are my options? I'm thinking about like how, so this grip here is what I need to do the swivel, but it's also what I need to do the projection. So I text a friend, and I'm like, hey. Actually, I called a friend. I was like, hey. I need shoes. I'm on top of a building. You know, they need to be like grippy kind of shoe, like a shoe that you would play volleyball in, something like that. So my friend, I could actually see him. He's at the event. I can see him walking down on the street, approaching people, and I can only see the conversation, so a little back and forth, and everyone going. And I could actually hear him. He got a little bit closer. I could hear him say what he was trying to do. God bless him. He was trying his best. He was saying, Adam needs Jews. And people were going, no. Leave me alone. So I'm standing up there watching. And eventually I resigned myself to the fact that this is my new life. I live on this roof. This is who I am. This is my perch from now on. So I'm looking down out on the street. And I kind of had this moment where I'm looking at everyone experiencing Mitchell Street. I'm feeling really good about it. I'm watching people. This is a place that I love. Mitchell Street oftentimes feels like it's haunted by its own past, haunted by its own ghost. And I was watching people engaging with it. I'm standing on top of a Somali grocery store next to an Indian grocery store. There's Lopez Bakery. There's Mitchell Mall across the street. And I'm really watching people engage with Mitchell Street today. And I started feeling good. And I got a call from my friend Shamia, who was in town. We were supposed to hang out. And I'm like, oh, Shamia, thank God you called. Can you get me some shoes? And she said, what? But we've been friends for a very long time, so she said, okay, I'll get you shoes. So she got my friend Juan Miguel, who I haven't seen since high school, to get me a pair of shoes. So Juan Miguel, he comes. I haven't seen Juan Miguel since high school. I'm looking down, and I'm like, hey, Juan Miguel, you got the shoes? He's like, yeah, I got your shoes. So Juan Miguel, he throws me up the shoe. I got the shoes. What I did was I swapped the shoes out, put my shoes back on, hit that swiv, back up, onto the fire escape, climbed up on top of the building, went back down, met up with my friend Shamia and Juan Miguel at a magical night on Mitchell Street.
And that was Adam Carr's harrowing escape.
You know, people like you and I show up at these things and admire works of art and, you know, maybe even participate in it a little bit. You don't realize what goes into creating it and setting it up so others can enjoy it. And this is a good story about everything that goes on trying to get your in this case, projection off the side of a building.
Yeah, it really makes you appreciate it that much more.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, and that I've been to that resurfacing Mitchell Street. It is so cool.
Oh, yeah. I never have.
I hope they redo it again for sure.
That'd be great, yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, all right, let's just wrap up, you know, today's art-related stories. So we want to remind everybody about our fantastic Exfabula Sculpture Milwaukee partnership coming up. Definitely check out exfabula.org for all of those details. That's going to be happening in a couple weeks. And
it'll be worth the walk, believe me.
It'll be worth the walk. Oh, aren't you on fire today? And we also have the Exfabula theme voting, which is happening right now, July 5th through the 17th. So definitely be all over our Facebook page and our exfabula.org.
And if you want to listen to these stories again or share them with friends and family, they are at WUWM.com and there's pictures too.
Excellent.
We'll be back next week with more fun and frolic.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune into our weekday version of the show at 10.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.